Reading for Am Shrimad Bhagavatam Canto 1, Chapter 16, Verse 34. Translation. O personality of religion, I was greatly overburdened by the undue military phalanxes arranged by atheistic kings, and I was relieved by the grace of the personality of Godhead. Similarly, you were also in a distressed condition, weakened in your standing strength. And thus, he also incarnated by his internal energy in the family of the Yadus to relieve you. Report. The Asuras want to enjoy a life of sense gratification, even at the cost of others' happiness. In order to fulfill this ambition, the Asuras, especially atheistic kings or state executive heads, try to equip themselves with all kinds of deadly weapons to bring about a war in a peaceful society. They have no ambition other than personal aggrandizement, and thus Mother Earth feels overburdened by such undue increases of military strength. The increase of the Asuric population, those who follow the principles of religion, become unhappy, especially the devotees or devas. In such a situation, the personality of Godhead incarnates to vanquish the unwanted Asuras and to reestablish the true principles of religion. This was the mission of Lord Sri Krishna, and he fulfilled it. Translation, O personality of religion. I was greatly overburdened by the undue military phalanxes arranged by atheistic kings, and I was relieved by the grace of the personality of Godhead. Similarly, you were also in a distressed condition, weakened in your standing strength, and thus he also incarnated by his internal energy in the family of the Yadus to relieve you. As we know from Bhagavad Gita and other scriptures, the Lord proclaims that he comes to this world to kill the demons and protect the devotees and establish Dharma. So this is quite commonly known as a reason for the Lord's appearance. Of course, we also have a more esoteric reason, and that is to give joy to the devotees. So more than to kill and to establish Dharma, the Lord, his main purpose is to give bliss to devotees. So in other words, his main characteristic is Bhakta Vatsala, very dear to the devotees. And what do the devotees want? They simply want to associate and serve the Lord. So by association with the Lord, the devotees get bliss, and the Lord gets bliss. So the quality of the Lord is ananda, his main characteristic, and that characteristic of ananda is expressed in his relationship with the devotees. Of course, we say that he expands as Radharani, Kladini Shakti is the personification in Radharani, and that Kladini Shakti becomes externalized as Radha, and then the Lord gets bliss through Radha. But similarly, the Lord gets bliss not only from his Kladini Shakti personified, but through all the jivas who are devotees. So that's his. That's the nature of the Supreme Lord. So there are many devotees in this world, and the Lord will show himself to those devotees and allow them to participate in his pastimes, and then they become joyful, and the Lord becomes joyful. So that is the position for the Lord and the devotees. It's the ultimate purpose. But the Lord is very clever, and therefore, when he does one action, he fulfills many purposes. So therefore, he also kills all the demons, protects the devotees, restores Dharma, etc. So he does many things when he appears. So, here, by his appearance, Krishna did two things in this particular verse. Of course, we find other things mentioned elsewhere, but in this verse, he took away the burden of the earth. Here's the atibharam, a great weight was there, and the Lord came and he destroyed that heavy burden on the earth. And what was that burden? It was the Asura Vamsa Rajya. It was the kings of the demoniac dynasties. They were the big burden. And they had troops. It says Akshohini Satam. So hundreds of Akshohinis. And in the footnote it says an Akshohini phalanx consists of 21,870 chariots, 21,870 elephants, 109,350 infantrymen, and 65,610 horses. That's one Akshohini. So it's a something they're using in battle. So these Asura kings, these demoniac kings, had amassed a great amount of armies. And the kings with these armies were the great burden on the earth. Yeah. So as Prabhupada explains in the purport, these atheistic kings, they build up their armies with deadly weapons. And then they have wars which destroy the population. Yeah. This is obviously a great burden on the earth. It is against the natural, let's say, stability of the earth to have such great disturbances. And of course we had battle of Kurukshetra and other battles as well, explained in the Bhagavatam. Yeah. But it is not just those historical wars. We can see that particularly in Kali Yuga, the wars have continued. There have always been wars among the human populations for some reason. They keep occurring. And we would think if civilization advances, human beings should find a means of living peacefully together. But we find that the more that we advance, that doesn't happen. We get more wars. So Prabhupada gave the example of the United Nations. This was formed after the Second World War because people felt that we don't want any more wars, so we'll, instead of having wars, we'll have some discussion together in the United Nations to prevent wars from occurring. Unfortunately, even before that, they had another group called the League of Nations, which didn't prevent the Second World War. And Prabhupada notes that, well, after the United Nations, instead of being united and having one nation out of many nations, they developed more nations. So the number of countries kept increasing and increasing in the United Nations. So rather than be united, they're more divided. Which means that people cannot get along together, and they have quarrels. We see that taking place all the time. The countries divide up into smaller and smaller groups, like in Europe, USSR divided up and suddenly it became many countries, and then Yugoslavia divided up into many countries, like seven countries out of one country. Czechoslovakia was one, divided into two. Many countries do this, they keep dividing. And even within India we see that they have these states, and then the states start dividing up among themselves. Andhra Pradesh became two states just recently, and before that Bihar became two states. So we keep dividing up and dividing up, which means there's differences that we cannot resolve, so therefore we'll be separate. So as well as that, then we have the, because we have to protect ourselves, then we have defense systems. We know that this is, of course, animal propensity, eating, mating, sleeping, defending. So it's natural that we have to defend ourselves. And the scriptures also justify this. If you're attacked, you have to defend yourself. You might have to do some violence if there is attack. Somebody sets fire to your house, somebody attacks your family, then you have a right to do violence. So in some sense, all human beings have this tendency to defend themselves and their families, or on the larger scale, a nation. So that's natural, but then this becomes an obsession. so that countries spend the majority of their money on defense systems. So instead of protecting the people by giving them food and good health, they'll build up their defense systems instead. And in that defense system, there are, as Prabhupada says in the first part, deadly weapons. And that has become, a prominent factor in modern warfare. The deadliness of the weapons. They keep inventing, they spend a lot of money investing in new inventions and new weapons. At one time it was nuclear weapons. And then there was such a concern because they understood that the human beings could destroy the whole world by nuclear weapons. So we had a lot of tension building up over the last century, let's say 1950s onwards, because of that. And it's continued to this day. But then besides those weapons, we have other weapons. And a lot of time and energy is taken to invent new ways of killing human beings. This is, in one sense, because we have to defend ourselves, yes, but then there's a certain extent beyond which we should not go, and it becomes a useless factor. Nevertheless, the leaders of society will do this with some sort of justification. And because they are atheistic heads or atheistic kings, the buildup of their defense systems and the wars that they wage are not actually just wars, which means they are for personal reasons, for their own benefit, material benefit, selfish benefit. So in the first line of this purport, Prabhupada says, the asuras want to enjoy a life of sense gratification. So that's the nature of a person in the material world. And an asura is one of those persons who wants to get that sense gratification while overriding dharma, rules of dharma. Vedic literature is very practical, and they realize everybody needs a little sense gratification in this world, and therefore they provide that. But you have dharma restriction. You can do something, you cannot do something else. And we see that within all religious systems. There is some regulation of the human being there. The demon, on the other hand, doesn't really care about those regulations of dharma. And even if they say they are religious, actually they are not. If there is a chance for their own benefit, they will take it, and they will disregard the principles of their own religion that say don't do this or don't do that. So that's the nature of a asura. So that's what we say, they're atheistic. Ultimately, their tendency to take things for themselves and enjoy is much stronger than any religious principle or dharmic principle. So that's the nature of the asuric leaders, and in Kali Yuga, such leaders become more prominent. In Krishna's time, they started growing up. Krishna appeared at the end of Dwarpa Yuga, so just next to Kali Yuga. Then there was a build-up of all these asuric forces. And consequently, it became very heavy for the earth. It was a very negative force. So the earth is here saying, this is a very great burden on me, very heavy weight. So often you will see in the Bhagavatam this accumulation of or increase of asuras is called a burden on the earth. And then Krishna comes to relieve the earth of its burden. And so it's quite a common phrase in the Bhagavatam. So we know that the donkey carries a burden, a very heavy burden, and the human being can carry a burden also. So we see many people are carrying things, especially in India, we see them carrying things, big loads on their heads or their backs or whatever like this. So that's a material burden. But then the other burden that the human being carries is all of his material desires and his anartas, and his lack of everything that expresses a lack of faith in the Supreme Lord. All this is a big burden on the human being, unnecessary obstacles for him. So the person is called the Bara Grahi, one who accepts the burdens, one who carries burdens. This is the nature of a materialist in this world. Why does he carry these burdens? Because he wants to enjoy. To enjoy, that he has to have all these desires and all these attachments. But at the same time, the attachments create a big problem for him. They exhaust him, they fatigue him, they confuse him. They make him fight with other people. They create all sorts of problems. So they're not actually beneficial, but he's carrying them. That all the people in the world are called Baragrahi. They are carrying huge burdens of anartas. The opposite of that is called the Saragrahi. Sara means essence, one who accepts the essence. So one who actually understands that we're not bodies, we are spiritual, and therefore our main purpose is not to enjoy our senses and accrue material objects. Rather, we should direct ourselves towards serving the Supreme Lord. So that's a Saragrahi. So the world is made up of these two types of people. We see from the beginning of the day of Brahma, when he starts manifesting all the different living entities. Actually, from the beginning of the universe, when he's first born. So we get nice entities like Prajapatis, Narada Muni, Kumaras, Manus, etc. Swayambhuva Manu, starting dynasties. And so we get, we can say, a saintly population. At the same time, Swargaloka, we have the Devatas, who are also devotees of the Lord, and they're there to bestow benedictions on the human beings if they follow Dharma. But Brahma also created, at the same time as he created the good elements, he created asuras, devas, and rakshasas, and all sorts of things. He created ignorance of different types. Moha and Tamisra and Andatamisra, all these things came out of the Lord Brahma at the same time. So from the very beginning of existence in the human society, we'll have the bad element and the good element, the devotional and the non-devotional. And they will conflict. There's always a conflict between them. So we see in the Bhagavatam how Hiranyakasipu fights, or Hiranyaksha fights, or other demons fight, and then finally Kamsa is fighting, trying to take over. Sometimes they manage to get up to even Swargaloka, like Bali got to Swargaloka even. So there's a constant tension within the universe throughout the day of Brahma. And sometimes the demons get stronger and stronger, and then they grab a little power. But David just fight back, push them down again. And so there's this constant rivalry between the Asura and the Deva within the material world. And that's expressed in the many battles we see in Bhagavatam, where we have great demons arising. So when Krishna was present, then it was Kamsa and all his allies like Jarasandha. They gathered together, and concentration was so great that the earth began to complain. It's a great burden. We cannot tolerate this anymore. And therefore the Lord came and he helped the devotees and the good forces to restore order within the universe. And then he put Yudhisthira on the throne. And then that restored peace in the universe. So this conflict will go on. The asuras can never be completely annihilated. They're just part of this material world. Just like we have spiritual world, where we have nitya siddhas and sadhana siddhas, then we have a material world, with jivas who are conditioned, buddha jivas. So within the material world, we'll find there is the bad element there, the asuras, and then we'll find the devotees of the Lord. So in other words, the material world is such that it constantly generates this asuric element. And though we can control them or minimize them to some degree, again, they rise up sooner or later. Tamaguna is inherent in Prakriti, so therefore it will manifest itself from time to time. So the Lord makes some arrangement to keep the balance there. So he puts the devas on top, Swargaloka, and the demons are in the lower spheres below the earth and other places. Or they climb up to the earth platform also, and they're on earth as well, or maybe a little above the earth in the Bhuvarloka sphere, whatever, also. But the Lord keeps a balance by favoring the devatas, favoring the devotees to keep everything in place. And therefore he has the Manus there, the descendants of Manus, the dynasties of kings to keep the balance. And when the demons rise up, then something has to be done to protect. So in this case we have Krishna himself appearing to restore the order of the universe. And simultaneous with this, we have in the second part of this verse the description of the bull, unapadam, which means minus the feet. In other words, Dharma is standing on one leg out of four legs. So he's in a very unfortunate position, which means that along with the burden of the earth and the rise of the demoniac kings with their armies, we have decrease in Dharma. And therefore, the bull has to lament, like the cow. But by the appearance of the Lord, an establishment of the Yadus on the throne, that is the Pandavas as well, then the Dharma was restored. And the bull could also be happy. In other words, two things go together, the Dharma and the burden of the earth, relieving of the burden of the earth. These two things go on simultaneously. So if Krishna restores Dharma, then automatically the asuras must be in a minority and the earth can be happy and function properly and yield produce for the human being. Yeah. So that's the basic relationship here. So the appearance of the Lord was there, but now Krishna disappeared. So then what's going to happen? Again, a Dharma rises up, bull is on one leg again, and asuras are very, very strong, overburdening the earth again, causing all sorts of problems, and therefore both of them are lamenting. The cow is lamenting and the bull is lamenting. Earth is in trouble and Dharma, religious principles, are in trouble. So that's the position. But as I mentioned yesterday, in spite of the fact that the Lord disappears, he does not abandon the human population. He makes some arrangement for them. So even if Kali Yuga is generally going in the direction of unqualified demons ruling the whole earth and destroying everything and having wars all the time for their own selfish reasons, still there is some hope for the people. The hope will not lie in restoring the kings again, because the nature of Kali Yuga is, particularly our Kali Yuga, is the whole line has disappeared. So it's very difficult to establish that line. So in place of a political solution, or a dharmic solution supported by a political ruler, which it looks impossible, the only alternative is to take shelter of spiritual life itself in the form of bhakti yoga and chanting the holy name. That's the solution for Kali Yuga. So when the sages ask the question, now that Krishna is gone, what's going to happen? Because Krishna takes Dharma with him. So what do we have? Then the answer is, Bhagavatam has arisen. And what is the essence of Bhagavatam? It is Krishna. He is the essence of the Bhagavatam. The main theme of Bhagavatam is Krishna Stu Bhagavan Swayam. So if we worship Krishna, particularly through the holy name, then we can, whatever is possible, we can, to some extent, we can contribute to the peace within this Kali Yuga. Kali Yuga means gradual disintegration, increase of a dharma, more and more as time goes on. So in that sense, it's very difficult to fight against that. But the solution is spiritual life in its simplest possible form, chanting the name of Krishna. So that's our solution. In one sense, yes, because it's Dharma and Earth talking and explaining the situation in Kali Yuga, and then Parikshit comes along and sees the bull suffering, and then he prevents Kali from entering. So you can say it's symbolic in that sense. But at the same time, and of course that's how you can, intellectuals will take it that way, it's all symbolic, but we also have to be careful that we don't take the whole Bhagavatam as symbolic, that Krishna is also symbolic. Yeah. Now that is done in some cases. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur in Krishna Samhita and other places, he analyzes all Krishna's killing of demons in terms of symbolism. That he killed this demon like that. This one means we defeat Buddhism. Another one, we are counteracting casteism like this. So each demon is an attempt of the jiva to overcome certain anartas. So he interprets the whole of the killing of the demons in that way. So we can take a symbolic interpretation of many of the pastimes from the Lord even. But at the same time, Bhaktivinoda Thakura says, well, we do this in order to appeal to the intellectual types in the modern world who really cannot accept that Krishna's there and he's killing all these demons, or that we have a history like this or a fantastic history like that. So for them, then you give a more logical explanation just to satisfy them. At the same time, we're not taking that as an absolute type of explanation, because we do accept the literal events of Krishna killing this demon or that demon. So similarly here, we could say this is more of a symbolic case. Sometimes the symbolism is explicit, as in the case of Puranjana, living in his city with the his different senses, etc., and getting attacked by old age. So that's a huge metaphor described to create detachment from the material body. So that one is definitely there, but this one's kind of a halfway in between, that it has real characters like Parikshit involved, the principles are there. But we could say yes, it's symbolic in one sense, but at the same time, spiritually speaking, we should not think that therefore there is no personification of Dharma and there is no personification of the earth in the form of a cow or whatever. Because there are Shaktis of the Lord, and they have forms, they have personalities. So there is a earth personality there. And she can take the form of the cow. And there is Dharma. Dharma, of course, is one form, is Yamaraj. He's an actual person. So this is another form of Dharma, the bull. So they can actually present themselves, even manifest themselves for the education of the world and to indicate to Parikshit Maharaj the nature of Kali Yuga, etc. They can actually appear like that also. It's not a problem for them. They can do that. So we can say we can take it metaphorically, but we can also say that it is literal as well. Oh yeah, yeah. Well, it's just like devatas. We cannot see devatas, and there's a Surya Deva and a Moon Devata, but we don't see those. We just see a moon in the sky or a sun in the sky. So we don't associate that with a person, but there are devatas there up in Svargaloka, and they're controlling all of this. But it's not like the sun devata has to sit in the sun and burn up all the time, or the moon devata sitting on the moon with all a bunch of dust and rocks. This is our conception of what the sun is and the moon is and whatever, and what Svargaloka is. We have a very limited conception of it. So the realm of the devatas is quite different from what we can even imagine, what to speak of a spiritual dimension. As opposed to Bhagavatam and?
Lord Caitanya and the Hare Krishna
Mantra. I guess it's a combination. One is equal to the other. Harinama is non-different from Lord Caitanya, and Bhagavatam is also Lord Caitanya, because Krishna is non-different from Lord Caitanya. And so Bhagavatam is representative of Krishna in Kali Yuga. Krishna is gone, but he has appeared in Kali Yuga in the form of Bhagavatam. And the holy name is not different from the Supreme Lord, so the name of Krishna is not different from him, so it's all one, actually.
So we're here in the 10,000-year golden age, so generally it's said that due to Lord Caitanya's appearance, it's inaugurated that golden age, so
would
that be correct understanding?
Yeah. Generally, Yuga is... like Satya Yuga is very sattvic, and Treta Yuga a little bit impurity, and Dwarpa more impurity, Kali Yuga more impurity, but there's always ups and downs within each yuga, so sometimes you have a big demon appearing in Satya Yuga. Some big disturbances there, and the Lord has to come to do something. So in Kali Yuga, it's going down, but then we have up again, we get some relief in the middle here, or at the beginning at least.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, according to the Lord's plat, we don't know what it is, but he makes arrangements. So he makes arrangements when Lord Chaitanya comes, that all these people appear simultaneously, and then they help him. And he's like his astras and his are his angas, his associates are his astras, and they protect him and they expand his movement. So similarly, but we don't know what his plan is, so we can't know that. But obviously, the Lord has some sort of plan for the whole of Kali Yuga and the Sankirtan movement, and then at certain times he makes certain arrangements for empowering different people to do different things.
Many people think that having to be good, so many bad things happen in the world. I sort of present that the world is exactly what it should be because of sinful activities.
Yeah.
There's going to be reactions.
Yeah.
We're going to blame God for it.
On the other hand, we cannot underestimate the power of the name of Krishna. So we don't know what's going to happen by that spread. And of course, we do see some things happen. More people are vegetarian in the world. You know, we wouldn't imagine that 50 years ago that it would be more public. And then, you know, famous people are saying, "I'm a vegetarian," but it happens now. So, you know, we can see some little transformations taking place. Well, it seems it was concentrated on the earth. That's why Krishna appeared on the earth. It doesn't have to. Sometimes we get up in the heavenly planets, like Bali Maharaj is up in heavenly planet, then Vamana has to come up there to solve the problem up there. In Brihad Bhagavatam, we see sometimes the demons get up to Brahmaloka even. Then Brahma has to run away and do this or whatever, make some other arrangement. So exceptional cases are there where they go upwards, but generally it seems like they concentrate on the earth planet. And the human beings here, particularly Bharat Varsha. And this is the center of their interest for some reason. The devadas and the demon competing for the influence over the human beings at the Bharat Varsha. Which is also like, physically speaking, we have upper planets, we have lower planets, and we have Bhumandala in the middle, you know, vertically speaking. And then in terms of Varshas, we have these other outer varshas, which are like heavenly, the dvipas, right? And then we get the Bhumandala, the Jambudvipa in the middle. And that, there we have varsha situated on one edge as the center of that whole conflict between the demons and the devas, competing for to influence the human beings. I suppose because it's more difficult to go upwards, and they're already down, so they don't have to fight in the down. But so they go a little bit up, and they come to the earth, and they try to get the human beings on their side. Now we can say, well, maybe that's also time. In one place in the Bhagavatam, it's explained that sometimes sattva is prominent, sometimes rajas is prominent, sometimes tamas is prominent, and accordingly. If tamas is prominent, then the demons get control. If sattva is prominent, then the devatas are in control. So basically when the demons get in control, they can't go too far, but at least they can start to penetrate into the svarga sphere, get the earth, and go upwards a little bit. But generally they have to be pushed down again, and the Lord makes some arrangement for that also. Okay, Hare Krishna.